Hello, Ange McCormack with you for the Hack Podcast. If you go to the pharmacy to get the morning after pill, would you want to be offered advice from the pharmacist to talk about your contraceptive options? Or would you want to grab it and get the hell out of there? Coming up soon on this episode, we'll talk about a trial that's gotten a lot of people riled up this weekend. Plus, you'll get the latest on the young Sri Lankan family in detention. They've had some good news today, but you'll find out why they aren't going home to Bilawila yet. That's all coming up on the Hack Podcast.
Hack. There's a sort of a question about what responsibility social media sites have when it comes to this sort of information.
On Triple J.
First on the show today, what have you discovered while scrolling TikTok? I've learnt some random life hacks, like how to clean my phone with blue tack, how to stop killing my indoor plants. For 23-year-old Matilda, it was something much bigger. Videos on her For You page helped her figure out she has ADHD. Getting diagnosed at a later age as a woman isn't unusual. A lot of the time it's because people miss the signs or don't understand what ADHD can look like. Have you or someone you know been diagnosed with ADHD? What impact did it have? I want to hear your stories. Call in 1300 055 36 or text in 0439 757 555. Here's Jo Lauder speaking to Matilda.
I just thought that, like, I was forgetful or clumsy or, you know, just sort of didn't have it together to the same degree that everyone else did. I'm Matilda Bosley. I'm a reporter for The Guardian Australia, and I'm also the co-host of the Old Boys Club podcast.
Like a lot of us, Matilda spends a lot of time these days on TikTok. The algorithm has built up a pretty good idea of what she's into and what weird rabbit hole she's been down. But when it started showing her videos about people with the neurodevelopmental disorder, ADHD, which stands for Attention Deficit Hyperactivity Disorder, she was pretty surprised, but also into it.
So many people related my last video, so here's part two of oddly specific things I experienced as a child with undiagnosed ADHD.
You might not have noticed, but I actually have ADHD, and so sometimes I really struggle with prioritizing my tasks. But so if that's an issue,
things your loved one with ADHD wants you to know, part
one. People with ADHD, like, try food and like it, and they get locked onto that food for months. It's so, so real.
So there's a lot of content on there from creators who have ADHD themselves, and sort of talk about how it manifests in sort of like every day-to-day adult life. And what was especially important for me was there was a lot of adult women talking about it.
When you think of ADHD, most of us know the stereotype of a little boy who usually mucks up in class and can't get anything done. But Matilda says she was seeing content that describes symptoms relating to what's known as executive function. These are the mental processes that help people self-regulate and do things like organising themselves and remembering things, focusing on tasks and keeping their emotions in check. And this hit home for Matilda.
Often I think I just assumed that I was lazy because it's sort of like, no, I really want to be able to, like, get this cleaning done. I really want to be able to send all these emails. I really want to be able to do all this stuff and, like, put these systems in place to just get my life in a bit more order. But there's something in me that I just can't do it.
And TikTok recognised that she was getting into these videos about ADHD and started feeding her more and more of them.
And it got to the point where, like, okay, no, maybe this is something that I should actually book in a session with my GP and actually have a discussion about this.
After seeing her doctor, Matilda got referred to a specialist who did some tests and then offered up a diagnosis.
He basically sort of looked at the results and said, like, no, no, you definitely have ADHD. I think you've had it since you were a kid. Like, your test result, like, it's a very high scoring result. And I remember just bursting into tears on the Zoom call because of that. It felt like such a relief after kind of all these years of just being like, for some reason, everyone else is kind of better at being like a human than I am. And it was just such a relief to be like, no, there's like a real reason. There's a clinically sort of legitimate reason, a chemical reason in your brain. And it's not just kind of been your failing this whole time.
There's a lot of ignorance about ADHD. There's a lot of undiagnosed ADHD.
Dr. Patrick Concannon has been a paediatrician for 40 years specialising in ADHD, and he's on the board of ADHD Australia. He says we've come a long way in our understanding of how ADHD presents in people.
We now know that there's a large group of people who have a slightly different ADHD, which is predominantly inattentive, we call it the inattentive variety.
Dr. Concannon says that for a long time, the boys and girls who had this inattentive kind of ADHD fell through the cracks. And like Matilda, they might not find out for years, or they might not ever get a diagnosis.
They usually don't present with behaviour problems initially, at least, but they present with difficulties with learning, difficulties with organisation, time management. They have trouble maintaining and developing motivation. They can then, of course, with this sense of negative self-image, they'll often then start to see themselves as failures.
One thing that came up when I was talking to Matilda about learning about ADHD from TikTok is that while it can be empowering and informative, it can also mean that impressionable people, and especially teenagers, end up misdiagnosing themselves.
I could see that it would be really, really easy for someone to convince themselves that this is something that applies to them and this is a diagnosis that that they have, and then not really being able to take no for an answer after that, especially when, you know, a lot of your free time that you're spending on this app is feeding you more and more information about this.
But Dr. Concannon isn't as worried about this trend on TikTok. He sees it as great for awareness, as long as people take it offline and get professional advice.
These days, the reality is that's there and it can be productive. Self-diagnosis can get you to the point of seeking formal assistance and diagnosis rather than, that's the important things, you don't self-manage.
Hack on Triple J.
Joe Lauder with that story. And on the Triple J text line, someone says, I'm getting tested for ADHD after seeing it on TikTok too. Someone else says, I'm exactly the same as Matilda. I'm in the process of being officially diagnosed, and it all started with memes on Instagram. That's really interesting. Let's talk to Rose Callahan. She's a comedian. She was diagnosed with ADHD at 32 years old, and she's an ambassador for ADHD Australia. Rose, how do you think TikTok videos about ADHD might have helped you if they were around when you were a teenager?
Well, yeah, I guess I would have been spending a lot of time online. There was no awareness for ADHD in women when I was a teenager at all. It was just seen as, you know, a thing that naughty boys had. Mm. So, yeah, I think TikTok's really good at educating about some of the symptoms of ADHD that are a little bit different, like rejection sensitivity dysphoria, or like emotional dysregulation. There's a lot of weird ADHD symptoms that people don't know about. And so, yeah, I definitely would have knew that I had it way earlier.
Right. And as someone with ADHD and a knowledge of how complex it is, you mentioned some of those symptoms there, does it sort of worry you about the potential misinformation that could be spread on TikTok? Like, it's a very sort of shallow message that often gets spread about health conditions on a platform like that.
Yeah. A lot of, I have been getting into the TikTok ADHD videos.
Yeah.
Let us watch them. And a lot of the videos are like, here's a crazy weird thing that you do if you've got ADHD, like drink soup upside down or whatever. And I'm like, that's not an ADHD thing. I don't know where you got that from. And it's got like 100,000 views. So, I mean, yeah, it seems to be like quite in vogue at the moment. It's right. been, because I'm an ambassador, I spend a lot of time trying to educate people about, you know, women with ADHD. And it felt like a year ago I was just shouting into the void. And then all of a sudden, everyone's getting diagnosed with ADHD. It's crazy.
Well, yeah, I suppose that's a good thing that people are recognising it and understanding it more. But also I've seen on TikTok some and other social media, like some people being kind of flippant about ADHD, using it really casually to say stuff like, oh, sorry, I'm really scattered today. I totally have ADHD, even when they probably don't. What impact does that kind of thing have on you for someone who genuinely does have it and potentially struggles with it?
Yeah, this is like something that I do struggle with a little bit. It's kind of like the new, like, oh, I'm so OCD, like, oh, I'm just ADHD. I've noticed a lot of people in groups I'm in saying like, oh, I've got undiagnosed ADHD. And it's like, well, you actually think that you've got ADHD. You can't diagnose yourself with it. You're not a doctor. And it is a little bit, I know people mean well, but it is a little bit disrespectful to people that do have ADHD, because it is like a difficult thing to deal with, and there are like a lot of negative repercussions in your life if you have it.
Yeah, I suppose it sort of undermines what people's real experiences are if you sort of just say it really flippantly. You're listening
exactly,
to Hack on
Struggle.
Yeah, you're listening to Hack on Triple J. I'm Ange McCormack. I'm with Rose Callahan. On the Triple J text line, Carrie, you say, TikTok has confirmed in my head that I have ADHD, but finding a qualified person to diagnose it in Adelaide is almost impossible. Rose, a lot of people talk about a feeling of relief when they get a diagnosis for ADHD. What feelings did you have when you were diagnosed?
Yeah, the same. It was really exactly what Matilda was saying. Like, it sounded like me verbatim. It was because it's just like, you just go like, am I dumb or am I just useless? You know that something's wrong with you, but it's not visible on the outside. So yeah, it's just a huge relief. And I was really happy when it happened.
And after you were diagnosed, you went on medication to help treat your ADHD. How much has it changed your day-to-day?
Like, just black and white. Like, I mean, you know if I have forgotten to take my medication because I start walking into rooms and forgetting why I walked in there and just trailing off in the middle of sentences. And, yeah, I mean, like, I had, like, heaps of, you know, tax returns that I hadn't done. And, I can actually function. And, it's good.
That's really interesting. And I suppose the other issue that people have raised on the text line, that one example we had about getting treatment in Adelaide, it goes to this problem about diagnosis. It isn't easy. It can also be expensive. What do you think needs to change so people don't struggle so much with getting a diagnosis?
Well, there is a real, like, in certain areas in Australia, there is a massive lack of access to people that can diagnose you. It's, like, super expensive. A lot of people might not know, but you have to see a psychiatrist to get diagnosed, and psychiatrists are super expensive. So if Greg Hunt, the health minister, is listening, please, Greg, can you please fund psychiatric services? Because the psychiatrists I've seen have cost anywhere between $450 to $650 an hour, and only a small portion of that is covered. You know, like, if it's $650 and you get $200-something back, like, that's a really...
It's a lot of money,
that you're taking. Yeah, and you have to see them to monitor, you know, your medication. And eventually you can get that transferred to a GP, but if there's a huge money, like, a barrier to the access there. And so, it's really important that gets funded.
Yeah, and just quickly, Rose, before we go, people listening today, especially young women with ADHD or young women trying to get a diagnosis, they might be feeling lost or struggling with how ADHD impacts their lives. What would you say to them? What advice do you have?
Well, if you're looking for a diagnosis, just, you know, go and see a GP, get a referral to a psychiatrist, and just go and look up what psychiatrists specialise in ADHD, because, you know, there are some people, like, you know, doctors in the community that aren't super supportive of it. But if you see an expert, and just book it in now, and there might be a big wait, but it will be worth it. Even if it costs a little bit of money, it is worth it, because it will change your life to get that diagnosis.
Rose Callahan, thanks so much for chatting with me today on Triple J.
Thank you.
On the Triple J text line, someone says, this is exactly my story. Diagnosed as an adult, so many tears of relief, then comes the hard work.
Hack. At this stage, it's like a day to 5 days after we last had sex. Like, nothing was even really, in my view, happening yet.
On Triple J. Have you ever gotten emergency contraception, like the morning after pill? The federal government's funded a new trial to run at some pharmacies around the country. It means pharmacists will offer people who buy emergency contraceptives some counselling or advice on their birth control options. It'll only be offered after the purchase, and it isn't mandatory to take it up. Have you ever gotten the morning after pill? Would you have wanted to talk about birth control options with your pharmacist? Call me 1300 055 36 or text in 0439 75 7555. A Daily Telegraph article about the trial got a lot of people riled up over the weekend, but as Tamsin Rose reports, the trial isn't quite what the telly made it out to be.
I'd just taken it as a backup pretty much. When my usual pill failed, I just was drunk and I threw it up and then didn't realise and missed the window to take a second one, and I went and got it.
That's Kira.
She's a 23-year-old living in Queensland. And the it she's talking about there is emergency contraception, or what you might know as the morning after pill. Kira was 19 at the time, and her story is very similar to the experience of many women who find themselves in that kind of awkward situation in a pharmacy when you're asking for emergency contraception.
I was already obviously pretty stressed considering the situation. You're never really choosing that as your first option to get the morning after pill.
Kira was one of a ton of women who contacted Hack about this new $2.5 million trial, asking why the government would make an already pretty shit moment even harder.
I feel pretty educated on what I do with my body. I was, 19. I was already on birth control. It's a conversation I'd already had so many times with so many different doctors. Then is not the time.
A spokesman for Health Minister Greg Hunt told Hack,
"This is an independent and peer-reviewed process, which is focused on giving people more choice and more information on the full range of contraceptive options for women."
Some very prominent Australians have slammed the idea. Victorian Minister for Women Gabrielle Williams accused the government of pushing a not-so-subtle pro-life agenda. Prominent sexual assault journalist and campaigner Nina Fennell said she feared rape victims would be shamed for not having taken birth control or questioned why their birth control had failed. But Monash's lead researcher and women's health expert, Professor Danielle Matzer, was shocked by the responses, and she's pleading with people to read beyond the headlines.
Once that young woman has purchased her emergency contraception, she'll receive the offer of the counselling, which she can take up or not. So it in no way will preclude or put a barrier in place around her purchase of the contraception. Emergency contraception is available over the counter.
Pharmacists at about 24 shops will be trained to offer the private in-store counselling to women. And only if they accept it will they then be taken through their ongoing options, things like the pill or an IUD.
Pharmacists will help her to access that contraception by referring her back to either a GP or local services relevant to her choice.
Professor Matzer wants women to know their options, not to force anything on them.
My plea to young women is find out more about contraception from trained health professionals, and then make your choice, because contraception is fundamental to women's ability to lead the lives that they want to lead.
A similar trial in Scotland found that there was a jump of 20% in the take-up of ongoing contraception by women who accepted the chat offered to them. Lots of people have been asking, well, how can a pharmacist even offer counselling if they aren't a trained counsellor? Anthony Tassoni, the head of the Victorian branch of the Pharmacy Guild, says there's no way a trained pharmacist would ever offer anything other than medical and pharmaceutical advice.
Within our pharmacy profession, when we refer to counselling, it's with regards to imparting information and advice around medicines. So a pharmacist will counsel a patient on how to take their medicine, extra information that's relevant to them, and give them some other information that they may need to follow up themselves or talk to their doctor about. It's really centred around medicine.
He says that pharmacists already inform patients at the time about their options when asked. This trial would just collect that data and see what those women who are advised end up doing.
This is not about pushing an agenda. It's actually about increasing awareness for women about the options available to them for their circumstances and needs.
Hack on Triple J.
Tamsin Rose reporting there, and on the Triple J text line, someone says, "No way would I want counselling. I've purchased it once and the pharmacist questioned me on the time frame. It had only been 8 hours. The pharmacist told me I should have used a condom." Let's talk more about this with Jamal Hakim. He's the managing director of Marie Stopes, which is a reproductive health provider. Jamal, what do you think of this trial?
Hi, Ange, and thank you for having me. Now, first of all, this trial is something that's trying to find out what works best and how we can provide access. I'm unsure whether this approach using counselling in pharmacy settings would be a good way to increase bodily autonomy. However, that's what the study is doing. That's really important. So we need to consider whether the approach is effective and whether the study is effective. But we should always start from the point where women and people with uterus must be able to access healthcare of their choice without judgment and free of barriers. so that they're not feeling judged in essence.
Yeah.
That's really important.
People are saying that there's a time and a place for those conversations at the pharmacy when you're buying the emergency contraception might not be it for a lot of people. Like, what's the solution here? Where else could that care and non-judgmental advice be offered?
That's a great question, and there are so many places where this should be offered. We at MyStops believe in a multidisciplinary approach. We should have access to information through different ways and ways that make sure that people are supported, that that is age appropriate, that's culturally safe, and it's trauma informed, so that people are getting those options, that advice, in a way that works for them and at a time that works for them. Things like contraception.org.au, for example, provide a whole range of contraception advice and access to what contraception best fits your needs, and that can be accessed online. But what's really important is, what are we trying to do ultimately? And I think, what are the barriers to contraception? Mm. And one of those key barriers is really cost.
Yeah, I was about to ask about that because, you know, one of the reasons people accidentally fall pregnant is because they can't afford contraception. What concerns do you have about that?
So there were lots of concerns here. What we do know is that someone who can get pregnant is often unable to afford contraception. So counselling sessions will not solve the problem. They need other options. Or their existing contraception may have failed, so it may not be about that. So what really must happen is government must invest in the provision of contraception and abortion care as well, so that people have choices.
Sorry to jump in there, but do you think contraception should be like free for everyone in Australia who needs it?
Ideally, yes. Ultimately, that should be the option. Why do women and people with uteruses carry this weight of social burden around contraception? It comes down to a cost that women are taxed with, women and people with uteruses. If really in a society that wants to ensure that women and people with uteruses have the maximum ability to take part in work, to take part in society, to do the things that they want to do in ways that they want to do them, contraception should be something that we provide for free. We know that investment in contraception has a massive social return. So it has an economic argument, it has a social argument, and it has a personal argument as well.
You're listening to Hack on Triple J. I'm with Jamal Hakeem from Marie Stopes. Sim, you've called in. You're a pharmacist. What do you think of this idea?
I think it's a great idea. I think it's something which is already going on quite a lot. And I just wanted to reiterate the statement from the Guild. It's that pharmacists are only really counselling around their specialty area, which is medicine. They're the first point of contact because they're the first place that people reach out to if they need some sort of help. This happens to be urgent to contraception. But they're trained to refer on to things when they encounter something outside of their scope of practice. So they focus on medicines. And if you just look at the number of interactions with the emergency contraceptive pill, there's about 90-odd interactions with different medications. That's kind of where their specialty is. So they want to be able to locate any sort of danger that might happen from just taking it and then evaluate if there's any other areas where they need to refer on to.
Something
which is already happening.
I think this wording of counselling has sort of gotten people thinking that it's about emotional support or something like that. But I believe the idea is literally more about, you know, the medical options that are on the table when you're, you know, thinking about contraception, right?
Yeah. Pharmacists are very aware of their specialty area and are aware of resources where other people, such as Marie Stokes and all these other kind of counselling specialists, have their areas, and we refer on to them when we can or when we need to, really.
Thanks so much for the call, Sim. On the Triple J text line, someone says, the assumption that women don't know their options is ridiculous. Emergency contraception is a last resort in specific circumstances. Well, Jamal Hakeem, thanks so much for chatting with us on Triple J. I'm sorry we don't have more time, but thanks so much for talking to us about this really important issue.
Thanks, Ange, for having me.
That's Jamal Hakeem, the Managing Director of Marie Stopes Australia.
Hack. The immigration status of the family has not changed. They are unlawful non-citizens.
I think it's a good short-term measure, but we won't stop pushing until they're back in Bilibili.
Are you saying that if you granted them visa and permanent residence, that it would start a flood of boats? Is that your view?
Absolutely, yes. On Triple J.
Over the past little while, we've been talking about the young family in detention limbo in Australia. Priya Anadis Murahapan and their two daughters have been in detention on Christmas Island for almost 2 years now. There's been a massive campaign for them to be resettled in Australia, in the town of Bilawila, where they lived before they were detained. Today there's been a big development in their case. Immigration Minister Alex Hawke announced the family will be released from Christmas Island. They'll be allowed to live together in suburban Perth in community detention. Let's unpack what this means for the family, though, with our political reporter, Shalila Medora. Shalila, the headlines have been a bit confusing today. Will the family be allowed to stay in Australia permanently? What's the story?
Yeah, I think it has been a little bit confusing. Even like the word release can sort of give people, a sense of what this announcement means. But a short answer to your question about whether they'll be able to stay here permanently is no. Today's announcement really just reunites the family. So as you said before, about 9 days ago, little Tanaka, who just turned 4 over the weekend, she got really, really sick with undiagnosed pneumonia, which led to blood poisoning. And she was flown to Perth's Children's Hospital. Her mum went with her, but her dad and her older sister, Kopika, remained on Christmas Island. They're the only detainees on Christmas Island. So over this last 9 days, the family's really been separated. And a lot of advocates have said, well, that's really bad, not just for the family's mental health, but for Tanaka herself while she's getting better. So today the immigration minister said the family can be reunited in Perth where they will face community detention.
Yeah, and what is community detention? I didn't quite understand it when I heard it today.
Yeah, so community detention has historically been used for asylum seekers while their claim is being processed. So while the government works out whether or not Australia owes them protection, it's seen as a little bit less harsh than other forms of detention. Mm. They're in the community, the kids can go to school, they have certain travel rights.
Like they just kind of live in a normal house, right?
They can live in a facility that might be within a community, okay. So it's not necessarily a house. The government kind of decides where they can live. But they also have certain rules that are set upon them. So, you know, the parents can't work, for example. Mm-hmm. They can't just hop a plane and, head off to see their mates in Bilawila. They might have curfews. So they don't have the same kind of freedom of movement that you and I have, but they're not as isolated as they would be in, say, community detention where, no one can visit them, or particularly on Christmas Island where they're the only people there.
Yeah, and there's been calls from some ministers inside the coalition, which is Scott Morrison's side, to let the family stay in Australia. Why have they come forward now?
Yeah, some of those names that our audience might recognise, like Barnaby Joyce, who used to be the leader of the National Party, and a few backbenchers. Backbenchers just means you're not a minister. They've called over the weekend for this family to be released back to Bilawila. As your question of why, I'm a bit of a cynic here, Ange. They've had years to come to this conclusion. This family's been on Christmas Island 4 years. Their case has been in the public for a number of years since the Bilawila community really brought it to our attention. So the question of why now? Well, I mean, the cynic in me would say because voters are changing. They haven't suddenly had a change of heart. It's actually the fact that they're recognising that voters are making this an issue and that voters are seeing this family cut through in a way that asylum seekers kind of haven't before. We've got an election coming up, maybe in the next couple of months, as early as then. So a lot of politicians are recognising this could be a political problem for them.
Just quickly, Shalila, the minister today said that this decision isn't a path to a visa. What pathways do they have left to get a visa and stay in Australia? Is it a possibility?
It is a possibility. There's a legal case that's ongoing and it's about whether Tanaka was given the right sort of process to be able to apply for protection. So that's the legal case that's ongoing at the moment. But I also want to make the point that ministerial intervention is the law. It's been used possibly thousands of times before. And it means that immigration ministers, when Peter Dutton was immigration minister, he intervened in the case of some au pairs. That is legal and we can do that. And that is really what advocates are really calling for, that the minister should use that power of appeal and step in and help this particular family.
Yeah, well, we'll be watching this case closely as we have been for the past little while. But Shalila Medora, thanks so much for chatting.
You're very welcome.
On the Triple J text line, someone says, if the young girl can survive sepsis, she's tougher than any of our federal politicians who only care about being re-elected. Someone else says, sad, but they shouldn't be here. They should be sent home. And James, you say, even after everything that has happened to this poor family, the government is still digging in its heels on its policy-driven position. It's a national shame.
Hack on Triple J.
Thanks so much for listening to the Hack podcast. I'll be back with you tomorrow.